This is Spencer Dobson. You are listening to the Dakota Free Press Podcast.
And I'm Corey Heidelberger. On today's show, Trump on the budget warpath against Indians. Mercenaries infiltrated the Dakota Access protests. Free pizza and Coke, brothers. Billy Sutton, our new blue dog. And our Dakota Free Press exclusive interview with Aberdeen school board candidate and conservative blogger, Ken Santema.
How are we doing this week, Corey?
We're doing great, Spencer. How are you?
Excellent. Well, it looks like it's not snowing on the day we record, so that's good news, nor is it raining.
Yes, and I tell you, I'm looking out today, and you're right, blue sky everywhere. Yesterday, too, I drove down to see our new Democratic gubernatorial candidate make his announcement. Gorgeous weather for that drive across the state.
Perfect, and we will get to that at the end of the thing. I personally am just looking forward to going to ride go-karts at Wiley Park.
All right, it is go-kart weather.
Okay, so we do have a tip jar. If you like our podcast, if you like what we do, please throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar. You can see it at the side of the Dakota Free Press podcast webpage, or it is also in the comments section. Who's our guest today?
Today we have Ken Santema, who is one of the school board candidates here in Aberdeen. We've got five people running for school board. The election's next week, June 6th already, so get out and vote if you haven't already.
Right around the corner.
And we've gotten to speak to four of the five candidates. Ken is the fourth. We're glad to have him on the program, and like you said, we'll talk to him later.
Awesome. Let's get started. I don't know that the Trump administration got a huge amount of support from the Native American community. And I don't think this is going to help.
No.
So here's what happened. The Trump budget, which you probably haven't read the whole thing. It sounds like the Trump budget is dead on arrival. But
Republicans have said it's dead on arrival. You're correct.
But apparently, here are some of the things that were in the Trump budget that if you're a Native American, you might not be that crazy about. $300 million cut to the U.S. Department of Interiors and Indian Affairs. A $50 million Indian country housing programs, $500 million cut to Indian country housing programs at U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And by the way, this information comes from an article that just talked about how desperately poor a lot of these areas are and how much this money is needed for people to just function, to have a basic life.
This was a national media article, and they came to Pine Ridge here in South Dakota, talked to tribal leaders, and they were saying these cuts that Spencer's listing would mean in some cases half of the budget that the tribes have to operate their services on disappears.
$150 million for Indian health services. Now, Kristi Noem, who is running for governor and has just got a great way of slanting things, and I'm using great sarcastically in case you didn't catch that, she ignores the budget talks. She ignores the budget, rather, and talks about transparency. I'll read this quote from her. There's going to be whistleblower protections built in and also provisions that will clearly state that IHS employees will report directly to members of Congress so that they'll have much more openness and dialogues as we go forward with some of these reforms. Noem said the bill also requires Indian Health Services to set standards for wait times and requires employees to learn Native American culture. Because the problem was the lack of transparency, not the fact that everybody's desperately poor and really is in need of help.
Right. And and she mentioned wait times, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you're waiting to see the doctor, that would imply that there are too many patients for the doctors you have.
Mm-hmm.
So logically, to lower your wait time, either there need to be fewer patients. Come on, Indians, don't get sick.
Right.
Not the approach. Or you need more healthcare staff to do that. But how do we get more staff?
Hugs?
I wish.
Oversight. You have people poke around in their stuff more. No? Is
no.
it money? It's money, isn't
ding, ding, ding.
It? It's
there
money.
It is.
Oh, yeah. Crap.
And you, I mean, you've nailed it there, Spencer. This has been a traditional tack for Kristi Noem on Indian health service issues. You know, even before we get the Trump budget out, and that's kind of the overarching one here, Kristi keeps saying she's concerned about all the shortcomings in Indian health services. But she never addresses the obvious, that if there aren't enough doctors and nurses and facilities and supplies to help Indian people get the care that our government is obliged to provide through, you know, treaty obligations and such, we need to spend more on that. She continues with this charade of saying, oh, well, the Indians just aren't managing things right, and the bureaucracy isn't managing things right, so we just need to change that, and money will magically shake out of the curtains. No, it won't. And so now, on top of Kristi refusing to acknowledge the obvious fiscal reality of needing to spend more on healthcare for Indian Health Service, Now we get the Trump budget, which, like you said, dead on arrival. Even Republicans think it's a joke. It wouldn't work. It's voodoo economics. But the Trump budget is still a statement of value. And Trump is saying, I don't value Indians.
Right.
I don't value their health care. I don't value the tribal operations. Nothing. If I had my way, I would cut their funding, which is the opposite of what they need, especially on Indian health services.
Absolutely. Next topic. Okay. This is a fun show this week. It's just a lighthearted toe-tapper that'll make you feel good about the world. Okay, The Intercept. And The Intercept is a periodical.
Online magazine.
Yeah, okay. It has obtained internal documents showing that Energy Transfer Partners employed the mercenary firm Tiger Swan. Great name.
Cool kind of ninja name.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, we're a tiger, but we're a swan, so yeah. We're elegant.
Crouching tiger, infiltrating swan.
Swan. Something. Anyway, so what Tiger Swan does is not cool dance moves.
No.
They're not a breakdance squad. They are not enough. What they do is they surveil, infiltrate, and undermine Dakota Access Pipeline protesters, which I'm sure many of the people who were protesting probably suspected that already. Well, it turns out you were right.
Yes.
In North Dakota, so they did this in North Dakota and all along the controversial pipeline's route. The leaked documents show local, state, and federal agencies coordinating their law enforcement effort with these private hired guns. The corporate fascism began under the Obama administration. By the way, I'm quoting this directly from the Dakota Free Press. You can find the article, obviously, on the blog. It is a very interesting read, and it will curl your toes. The report also revealed a widespread and sustained campaign of infiltration and protest, infiltration of protest camps and activist circles. Throughout the leaked documents, Tiger Swan makes reference to intelligence gathering teams, which infiltrated protest camps and activist groups in various states. Tiger Swan agents using false names and identities regularly sought to obtain the trust of protesters, which they used to gather information they reported back to their employer, according to the Tiger Swan contractor.
Yeah, if you look at the Intercept article, and I will have a link to that at the bottom too. It's where I got my article from.
Okay.
They have links to the actual, they call them the sit reps, the situation reports, written in very military style. I mean, these Tiger Swan guys, they're former military members, served overseas in Iraq and all that kind of thing. And they treated their work for Dakota Access, for Energy Transfer Partners, the company, the Texas company building the pipeline, they treated it as a military counterinsurgency, counterterrorism operation. And they wrote these reports up with reference to, like, you know, the enemy, the protesters as enemy, referred to them as jihadists and terrorists. Among the notes in the situation reports, the sit rep from September 11th talked about Tiger Swan sending a team in to a protest against Dakota Access in Sioux Falls. So they had staff on the ground, not just in North Dakota, not just at the big camp up at Standing Rock, but here in South Dakota, going and listening in and infiltrating and pretending to be on the side of people who were just going out in the street to, you know, exercise their First Amendment rights.
Right.
And they were taking notes and reporting back to Texas saying, here's what's going on. Here's who we have to look for.
In an October 3rd report, Tiger Swan discusses how to use its knowledge of internal camp dynamics, exploitation of ongoing native versus non-native rifts, and which that made it to the press all the time, and tribal rifts between peaceful and violent elements is critical to our effort to delegitimize the anti-DAPL movement. On February 19th, Tiger Swan makes explicit its plans to infiltrate a Chicago protest group. Tiger Swan Collections team will make contact with event organizers to embed within the structure of the demonstration to develop a trusted agent status to be cultivated for future collection efforts. So they were putting guys in these protests to pretend that they were protesters who were there to collect information and to, you know, put pressure on rifts or to exploit any frictions,
to sabotage
any
efforts.
Yeah, frictions within the group.
And we heard about, you know, there were conflicts within the Standing Rock camp and protesters. There were people who wanted totally peaceful, nonviolent protests.
Mm-hmm.
There were others who advocated violent action. Mm-hmm. We heard about that in the press. But what these memos prove is that Energy Transfer Partners hired these mercenaries to make those rifts worse. So while, like, Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault and other, you know, Native leaders who were there trying to resolve differences and create a united front, you know, the protesters were trying to do a good protest.
Right.
They had the bad guys.
Right.
We can call them that. Sneaky mercenaries who were lying about their intentions, who were happy to make those rifts worse, and thus we could say were there encouraging that kind of violent activity and undermining the efforts of the tribal leaders to tamp that down,
right?
All because they knew it would, like you said, delegitimize the effort. Well, and not like you said, but like Tiger Swan said, right, we're here to delegitimize the protest. So you've got mercenaries hired by the corporation, Energy Transfer Partners, yeah, encouraging violence in the camps.
Yeah. So tribal leaders are saying, let's have a dialogue. And there's somebody in the group going, let's burn some stuff. And people are like, I think that guy, we should burn some stuff.
Right. And that's, see, and that's the thing. We know those factions were there, mm-hmm, but left alone, who knows how that would have worked out? The right tribal leaders would have had a better chance to fix that.
Absolutely.
Like you said, when you've got infiltrators and instigators, right, encouraging the violent side.
Let's throw fuel on the fire.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's scary.
Yeah.
You know, scary, yeah, scary really for anybody who, right, wants to do protests. And that's something that flows out of these memos. Even now, in May, I mean, the Dakota Access Pipeline is built. They're going to start putting oil through it probably today as we speak, June 1st. Mm-hmm. But there are memos from May from Tiger Swan to Energy Transfer Partners. They're still on the payroll, and they're still trying to stay on the payroll. Tiger Swan is telling Energy Transfer Partners, hey, all those activists, they're shifting to other tactics. They might do vandalism and other protests, so we got to keep tabs on them, and you guys got to keep paying us so we can watch these protesters. This is not just a one-off. Mm-hmm. This is an ongoing effort of corporate America, both the oil guys and these mercenary, these private security paramilitary groups,
right,
trying to quash First Amendment activities.
Right.
All for the sake of a corporate buck. This is scary stuff.
It's a fun episode. Well, here's news.
This is good news.
Is it?
Yes, it's free pizza.
Yeah, there's no free pizza.
There is free pizza.
You don't get a free lunch.
No. It's free supper. It's free supper tonight. You may, this podcast will
you won't
be
hear
out
it.
Eating,
yeah,
pizza.
Yesterday you missed it, but there's no free ride, man.
No,
you got to pay the piper.
There is free pizza at the Pizza Ranch in Aberdeen on June 1st, brought to us by
the
Americans
Cook
for
Brothers.
Prosperity.
Yes, the moral case for capitalism by Americans for Prosperity, and I feel like a lot of these, if you're paying, you know, kind of half paying attention, you hear the name the Koch brothers a lot.
Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, Koch brothers.
And you probably hear Americans for Prosperity a lot, and you probably hear the term AstroTurf periodically. But let's discuss, first of all, let's say, tell people who these people are. Because, again, I think, I don't know. I think sometimes it's good to slow down and,
sure,
look at all the parts again, because if there's one thing I've learned in life, it's that people hate to say, I don't know.
Right.
So let's just, first of all, let's tell you who the Koch brothers are.
You're about to ruin my free pizza, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. Koch brothers. Who are they?
Let me, I'm scrolling. Okay. The phrase the Koch brothers generally refers to the sons of Fred C. Koch. The most politically active sons are Charles and David, who bought their brothers Frederick and Bill out of the company. David H. Koch was a Libertarian Party vice presidential candidate in 1980. He advocated for the abolition of Social Security, the FBI, the CIA, and public schools. What a guy.
That's a very libertarian approach to things. No schools, federal police, or Social Security.
Right.
Oofda. Okay.
Koch put $500,000 of his own money into the race, and he and Ed Clark, his presidential running mate, won 1.1% of the vote. The experience of running for office caused David Koch to change course. I've had enough. We are not a nation that debates issues. We vote on candidates' personalities. In 1984, David had parted company with the Libertarian Party because he said they nominated a ticket I wasn't happy with, and so many of the hardcore libertarian ideas are unrealistic. Jane Meyer, so they basically got involved in other kind. They started a political action committee. They do what is known as AstroTurf. This is a grassroots organization. Is actually AstroTurf. AstroTurfing is the practice of masking sponsors of a message or an organization, example, political advertising, religious or public relations, mm-hmm, to make it appear as though it originates and is supported by grassroots participants.
Sure. So it's really coming from some big, rich organization, rich and powerful people.
Right.
They make it look like it's coming from just regular folks, from your neighbors right. spontaneously erupting and saying, we need to change this.
And this is currently really ironic because the right is constantly accusing the left of using paid protesters, which is what the right uses.
Kind of like we heard on the Dakota Access stuff, isn't
That's it? That's exactly right. And also, even at the Cracker Barrels, Al Nordstrom was accusing the Women's Day protesters from after the Trump election. He was like, oh, those are paid protesters. Well, no, they're those are real grassroots. You make fake grassroots.
But now the Koch brothers, who, and I guess Americans for Prosperity is one of their biggest political organizations in the country. You're saying the Koch brothers are doing AstroTurf here in Aberdeen.
Tonight.
Tonight with their free pizza. Ranch.
You get free pizza and you also get a head full of crap. Here's who, and they're it's under their organization, Americans for Prosperity,
right.
which is a right-wing political advocacy group founded by billionaire brothers David and Charles Koch.
Billionaires. And that's billionaires with capital B's.
Billionaires, the owners of Koch Industries. AFP, Americans for Prosperity, serves as the Koch's, quote, grassroots, unquote, operation. Again, also known as AstroTurf, which we just explained. AstroTurf, something completely different.
Oh, my. Don't do it.
Great movie from the 70s. AFP spends millions on TV ads and election cycles. In the 2012 election cycle, it was a key component of the Koch's $400 million political network, receiving large portions of its money from Koch-linked dark money groups like Freedom Partners, American Encore, and Donors Trust. AFP's budget, which comes from the Koch Family Foundation and other unknown sources, surged from $7 million in 2007 to $40 million in 2010 and $115 million in 2012. According to the Center for Public Integrity, Americans for Prosperity spent a staggering $122 million in 2012 as it unsuccessfully attempted to defeat President Barack Obama and congressional Democrats, including $83 million on communication, ads, and media. AFP's messages are synced with those of other groups funded by the Kochs and Kochs' other special interest groups that work against progressive or democratic initiatives and protections for workers and the environment. Accordingly, AFP opposes labor unions, health care reform, stimulus spending, and any effort to combat climate change, including President Obama's 2015 Clean Power Plan.
Boy, now I got to tell you.
So that's neat.
Not so long ago, Democrats in this state got caught grief from the Republicans because they'd have chili feeds, mm-hmm. you know, out in the reservation to say, hey, come get some chili, and then we'll all get in a bus and we'll go vote.
Right.
And they were like, oh, you're feeding people to buy their votes, blah, blah, blah. Now the Koch brothers, the conservative right. capitalists who are coming tonight to Aberdeen, they're preaching what they call the moral case for capitalism mm-hmm. by giving out free pizza.
Right.
You tell me who's trying to buy votes here.
Well, and let me, this is such a telling quote here at the end. Jen Meyer, who much of this information came from, wrote a book called Dark Money about the Koch brothers. And she ends the book with a quote attributed to Charles Koch as a boy. When called upon to split a treat with others, he would say with a wise guy grin, I just want my fair share, which is all of it.
How very nice.
How chilling.
Well, at least he's going to share some pizza with the good people of Aberdeen evening.
And here's why I'm not going, because I clicked on the link for the thing.
Right.
By attending this Americans for Prosperity Foundation event, you irrevocably consent to authorize AFP Foundation and its affiliates, related companies, contractors to record, film, photograph, and capture during the event and related events your likeness or image in any media whatsoever, and to distribute, use, broadcast, or disseminate in perpetuity such media for any purpose whatsoever without any further approval from or any payment to you. The images in all media will constitute AFP Foundation's sole property. By filling out this registration form, you confirm that you are at least 18 years of age. So they can put you in an ad if you go to this. That's why I'm not going.
Well, I'd go, but just put on your Bernie Sanders shirt. Let them put that in an ad.
But this one, I don't know. This might work out, and it might not. But we're
getting closer to better. We went from Trump waging war on Indians, which is bad, mm-hmm. to mercenaries waging war on Indians in the First Amendment, which is bad.
Right.
Then we got free pizza. That was almost good until you wrecked it with your talk about the Koch brothers.
By learning things.
By learning things. Oh, cursed knowledge.
Dummy.
But now we have an actual Democrat running for South Dakota governor.
Well, and you're more familiar with Billy than I am. I know Billy. I did a little bit of homework on him this morning, and that's what's brought this conversation about. He's been a senator.
Yeah, this is Billy Sutton. He is a state senator from Burke. That's down in south central South Dakota, just on the west side of the Missouri River there.
Right.
And I drove down to his announcement of his gubernatorial campaign Wednesday. And it was at his ranch. And I tell you, yesterday's campaign announcement at the Sutton Ranch on the banks of the Missouri River was literally picture perfect. It was 70 degrees. The sky was clear blue above, a little bit of white puffy cloud way off in Nebraska somewhere. Where this ranch sits, it's this beautiful log ranch home with a huge covered porch on the south and east side. It looks out at the Missouri River Valley and the river down there, and everything is green.
Right.
But things are most beautiful in the spring. I mean, it's been dry around, but we've still got that spring green left. So if just from a pure campaign imagery perspective,
right,
that Billy Sutton's announcement for governor, his speech on a flatbed trailer with the flags flapping in the wind in front of this beautiful vista of South Dakota. I mean, they got all the campaign photos and video they needed probably just yesterday.
And Billy is a legit cowboy, right?
Yeah, yes, he is. He grew up. I mean, this is cowboy country.
Sure.
You go down there, as I drove into the ranch, you know, at least half the cars, if not three quarters, were pickup trucks. They have a working ranch. They gave kids stagecoach rides.
Right.
On their own stagecoach with their own workhorses.
Sure.
He's a legitimate cowboy. He went to, I believe they said, University of Wyoming. He was on the rodeo team. In his speech yesterday, he said he was ranked in the top 30 worldwide for professional rodeo guys. So, I mean, when Billy Sutton puts on a cowboy hat, he means it.
Right.
This isn't pretend cowboy stuff like some people do. But that all changed several years ago. He was in the chute at a rodeo. Boom. Horse flipped over on him. Instantly paralyzed. He's been in a wheelchair since. So now he works in finance.
And it's his lower extremities. Upper extremities.
Yep, okay. Lower extremities. I mean, his arms are all good and all that. He gets around the wheelchair great, drives himself. I mean, you know, perfectly independent life, but he had to, and he still works on the ranch. They still have the ranch. He still rides horse. You know, he's still involved in the operation there, but obviously he's not doing rodeo. But that was a point at which his life changed, and he talked about this a lot in his speech and said, you know, I need to find other ways to serve the people who've been so good to me here in South Dakota.
Super inspirational.
Oh,
incredibly inspirational.
Definitely. And he's, you know, he ran for legislature in 2010. His dad, or his grandpa, excuse me, had been in legislature previous to that a long time ago, even ran for lieutenant governor once, I think, in 1978. So in a way, Billy's following in some family footsteps.
Sure.
But he ran for legislature in 2010. He won two elections in a row, and then he was unopposed the two after that. So he's been in the Senate for 8 years. He's come to be Senate Minority Leader for the Democrats.
Okay. That's all good things in South Dakota. Let's look at him as a Democrat, though, because this is where it's one thing to have a D by your name or an R by your name, but it's another thing. It depends on how you vote is how that actually matters.
Yeah.
And again, all of those, that whole backstory is amazing, and he sounds like an incredible person. But as the Koch brothers said, people vote for personalities. I'm interested in issues.
Yeah. And it's worth looking at some of the issues.
So let's look at some of the issues here. So he's got a 100% approval rating by the NRA.
Yes.
Now, this is South Dakota, so I can see how that happens. But does that mean he's going to make reasonable gun legislation, like he's going to block reasonable gun legislation? What's he going to do about that? And it matters. And especially in South Dakota, where we love our guns so much. Is he going to be able to make sound choices on that front?
And that's a very good question. Again, you look at where he's from. It's not just that it's a Republican district. It's a rural district. It's a ranch district. It's a hunting and fishing district.
So, you know, and again, this gets down to the argument. If you want a Democrat to win, maybe he's going to have to like guns a little more than the other person. And that's what matters. But then does the D matter if he acts like an R?
And that's the challenge. We're going to see it on the other issues we discuss here. If he were a Corey-style Democrat,
right,
who ups and says, you know, there should be sensible limitations on guns. Although really, I don't know any South Dakota Democrat who says, let's get rid of guns.
Right.
Nobody says that.
Nobody is saying, let's get rid of guns. Like, three people are saying, let's get rid of guns.
Yeah, and nobody listens to them because they're nuts. But Billy's A rating from the NRA. I don't know if that one indicts his Democratiness as much as maybe some other stuff.
Sure.
Simply because I think a lot of the perceived, you know, dichotomy on gun issues in South Dakota and nationwide
right.
is that Republicans love guns and Democrats want
right.
to ban them,
right.
which is absolutely false. So you could argue that in a way you can get an A rating from the NRA just by supporting hunting and, you know,
sure.
kind of
sure.
decent possession of guns, that sort of thing. It's not that crazy.
Well,
to have an A from the NRA.
This is why we have discussions.
Exactly. Although even, you know, for perspective, Stephanie Herseth-Sandlin once upon a time, I believe, had an A from the NRA.
Okay, but
so
let's go down the list for something a little more that makes me a little less comfortable. A 75% approval rating by Pro-Life South Dakota.
Yes.
Which is, that's pretty strong for Pro-Life South Dakota if you're a Democrat. And I realize, you know, there's an argument, and I heard this in South Dakota, Colin Peterson.
Oh, from Minnesota.
Colin Peterson, Blue Dog Democrat, who was, he did a lot of, he was a Blue Dog Democrat. So, you know, again, he's got a D by his name, but a lot of his voting is going red. And so what's the point?
Well, and we've seen that with Sutton. Now, remember, Sutton has only faced election twice.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans didn't even bother with him the last two times, which says he's strong in conservative country. 2012, South Dakota Right to Life did give him a 75% rating. They said, yep, we can work with Sutton. He does our thing here. And he did vote for certain abortion restrictions
right, well,
in the legislature and information requirements and things
right.
like that, that, you know, I will say, no, these are totally bad restrictions.
Well,
we shouldn't have these.
And with the current administration being so, it's so hard to say right now what's going to get through and what's not going to get through with the
right.
Trump administration, because it's such a ridiculous gelatinous ball of crazy that's being thrown at us. But, you know, reproductive rights matter. They affect women. They affect
yes.
children. They affect people. They affect the job force. They, you know, and you can't mess around with it. Now, and it's so difficult, because one, you know, the common knowledge is in South Dakota, you have to play politics, so you have to go, well, I'm going to, you know, I don't know if he's gaming the system, like I'm going to pick my battles with abortion so that the anti-abortion people will still kind of trust me, or, you know, it's frustrating.
Yeah, you hit on the issue there, because, sure, obviously, a Democrat running in South Dakota would love to be able to shut down any opposition they might get from the single-issue abortion voters
right.
and focus the discussion elsewhere. And that's exactly what one of my Republican commenters on Dakota Free Press said right off the bat last night. When Sutton announced yesterday, this Republican friend commented and said, well, now we have the Republicans and the Democrats agreeing that abortion should be restricted, so we
right.
can move on to other issues.
Which is, see, and we don't.
Yeah, well, see, and that's it. I like the idea that we could spend an election maybe moving on to other issues
sure.
that have a larger impact. But at the same time, there are a lot of Democrats, myself included, and I think yourself included,
yeah.
who recognize that, no, actually, abortion is a significant issue, and free constitutional access
yes.
to abortion services and all women's health services,
right.
plus respect for women's equal citizenship and autonomy,
right.
matters a whole lot. And
yeah.
we need people to lead that conversation. So I'm disturbed that if we're going to have a Democratic gubernatorial candidate saying, yeah, we should ban abortion. I don't know if Billy goes that far. I don't think he'll go that far. But if he's basically going to concede to the Republican narrative, that leaves a lot of people out who want that discussion to say, wait a minute, like
yeah.
you said, abortion rights matter.
Yeah, it moves the marker really far into the other field.
Yeah, so we understand that it's really hard to get elected as a Democrat who says, I support the right of a woman to control her own body and have an abortion if she sees fit.
Right.
We understand the pragmatic side of that. The question for Democrats who recognize the importance of reproductive rights are, okay, number one, you don't like Billy. If you don't like Billy's stance on abortion issues, does that really mean you're going to vote for Kristi Noem or Marty Jackley instead? Of course not. Because Marty Jackley and Kristi Noem will take us straight to the Handmaid's
right,
Tale.
Right.
Billy can probably keep those votes, but there's the question of enthusiasm. Will all those votes
right.
bother to show up? Well, will they fundraise? Will they donate? Will they tell neighbors to vote for him?
And is it a matter of the populace holding his feet to the fire and then he'll do whatever the public tells him to do? So if it's important to you, you have to keep calling him. But I think, you know, I guess when I call Kristi Noem, I'm sure they write it down. I don't think she cares. On the other hand, with Sutton, you know, you might be able to call him and say, you know, here's what I think. And if enough people call him and tell him what they think, that will guide his decisions. You know, so obviously it's up to the populace to stay informed and to stay active. But there is also, like, in this bizarro Trump world that we live in, can you be mushy? Can you, do you need, I mean, it's not like Trump stands for anything.
Right, right.
So do you fight that by firmly standing for stuff, or do you fight that by being vague and then, you know, Trump just wants to win. And we're trying to get stuff done and live here.
And, you know, I cannot see Billy Sutton playing Trump in any substantive way.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had conversations with him before yesterday, but we did a 5-minute interview. That's on Dakota Free Press. I listened to his, it was about a 13-14 minute announcement speech. Billy's a pretty straightforward guy.
Okay.
As the campaign goes on, and we've got 14, 15 long months of campaign now, if he's asked about abortion, if supporters ask him or the press asks him, he'll tell you where he stands.
Yeah.
He'll talk about the votes, and you can look up votes on bills in the legislature. Billy Sutton will be straightforward with the voters. And then, yeah, I mean, I'm interested by what you say about how it is up to voters to let him know what they think.
Yeah.
If there are lots of us Democrats who say, wait a minute, women's rights need to be an issue of this campaign, and we need our gubernatorial candidate to lead that discussion, be a moral leader and a political leader. You know, if enough of us speak up, Billy will notice that, and he'll have to figure that out. I mean, it's the same with Kristi and Marty. Mm-hmm. I would assume the only reason they're as passionate on you know, abortion issues as they are is that they hear lots of people saying, oh, if you save babies, we'll vote for you.
Right.
But, you know, got to make ourselves heard.
You know, and again, when you... It's one thing to learn about this issue from the media, but it's another thing when you go and really talk to people. And when you really talk to people, it affects people's lives a lot. And everyone has really, impassioned opinions on it. And it turns out this is a matter that really, you know, you're deciding whether or not women have control over their destiny, basically, with the abortion issue. I know we kind of talked about this in pre-show before we started recording, but I don't know. I know South Dakota has the illusion of being very conservative. I don't know if that's smoke and mirrors because we're a heavily gerrymandered state. I don't know how many people are looking at what's happening now that the conservative dream is becoming a reality and going, this is awesome. And how many people are looking at it going, oh my God, we have to wake up. We have to pay attention. Well, we have to put more effort into
and
this.
I will not posit a guess as to how accurate the conservative and liberal labels are for like what percent of South Dakota is blank. And that may not matter because, like you say, when the practical details of like the destructiveness of, say, the Trump budget, and I know we're talking about Billy Sutton running for South Dakota governor, but the things that are happening in Washington are going to trickle down
through
the whole ballot. It's going to color the whole year. And yesterday I heard Billy Sutton say something very interesting that suggests he's ready to play that game.
Right.
He talked about actually it wasn't Billy. I mean, Billy talked a lot about, you know, understanding people who are suffering, people who are left behind, that sort of thing. But the line I'm thinking of actually came from Bernie Hunhoff, a publisher of South Dakota Magazine, former legislator himself, well-known in Democratic circles. And he said about Billy that Billy is respected by the establishment. Interesting line. But he said that Billy also always is the first guy to stand for the forgotten.
Oh, good man.
Now, the forgotten, remember, Donald Trump talked a lot about the forgotten people.
Right.
I think Billy Sutton senses, and with that line from Bernie Hunhoff, he senses there are a lot of people who are forgotten in the Trump budget.
Sure.
Go back to the Native Americans we were talking about at the top. Talk about rural cuts. I mean, I looked at one part. He's eliminating three programs that, I mean, single-family housing, support through USDA, economic development grants through USDA, wastewater and water infrastructure from USDA. These are things that are vital to South Dakota. $237 million of funding last year, and Donald Trump would say, get rid of it. Donald Trump is forgetting rural America.
Right.
if Billy Sutton can come out and say, I'm not forgetting rural America. You folks have been forgotten by Trump, and you've been forgotten by kind of the corrupt, right, self-serving politicians in Pierre, which he made a big deal of in his speech yesterday. If Billy can turn that line, that's going to turn a lot of people back on. People aren't going to think whether they're conservative or liberal. They're going to hear Billy Sutton talking about real concerns for them, and they're going to flock to him.
Right. Well, and the problem for Republicans and the status quo basically is, mm-hmm, I think up until this election, a lot of people looked at politics as the Vikings and the Packers. Mm-hmm. I vote Vikings because my dad voted Vikings. I live in Viking territory. I vote Packers because we've always been Packers. But suddenly, it's not about who wins the Super Bowl. It's like, okay, the Packers are going to take away your benefits and your health care. So, mm-hmm, maybe you've always been a Packer fan, but now the Packers are really altering the reality of your life.
Right.
I know it's going to hurt a little bit, but you might have to go start cheering for the Vikings over here a little bit, because,
right, yep,
they want to make sure, you know, that the roads stay paved and that people get their medicine and that people have rights and that America is on the world stage and is still friends with even people who like soccer.
Yeah. And I think that observation makes some good sense, because, you know, at the top of our conversation here, we were talking about people who aren't just Democrat fans,
mm-hmm,
and people who, not just people who kind of show up and vote D because they like D's, but because they're deep down Democrats and have, right, the Democratic Party principles. You, right, and I are talking about the Democratic base. Now, when you talk the Vikings-Packers dichotomy, yeah, you're talking people who just, they maybe don't pay attention to the party politics or the,
right,
platform issues.
Right.
They're just rooting for a name.
The bar I drink at likes Trump.
Yes, and so that's where they'll go.
Right.
If Billy, you know, maybe he doesn't worry so much about the party label. That pains me to hear, yeah, that. But he's thinking about, how do I appeal to all of the people,
right,
who will be hurt by Trump? And,
right,
all of the people who've been hurt by 40 years of one-party rule in,
right,
South Dakota.
Right.
He may phrase his argument that way, and that's a practical way to win elections. It, mm-hmm, may not satisfy the base, but it doesn't mean the base is all going to go vote for whoever the other party offers.
Well, and I'm so torn about this. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I hate to see ideas compromised. At the same time, the ship took a hard turn, and you shouldn't, mm-hmm, turn ships hard.
Right, right, right.
So turning it back, it's going to be, we're going to incrementally bring it back to where we need it to be.
Yeah.
And we have to, we, you know, if him being a little soft on abortion means more people come under the umbrella, and then maybe we can explain the abortion issue to people, mm-hmm, in a way that will make more sense to them once we aren't falling off a cliff.
Yeah, the ship, cliff, all of the analogies we have going here.
The ships fall off cliffs. That's,
if they turn too hard, yes.
Okay, maybe it's a bus.
Yes.
You also don't do sharp turns in buses.
Whatever,
because they roll
driving,
over.
Whatever we're driving, there is a practical argument that, yeah, we need to get Democrats in positions of power first so they can better lead those conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one other thing you got me thinking of, you were talking about how, you know, people need to get out, candidates need to get out and talk to the people.
Right.
People need to get out and talk to the candidates. So far, I mean, this is Billy Sutton's first statewide election.
Mm-hmm.
Every election he's done has been in District 21, few counties in South Central, mm-hmm, South Dakota, a very conservative area. Now, as he gets out to run statewide, he is going to encounter a broader swath, a more diverse swath of the population.
Right.
That may affect the things he talks about as well,
sure,
as he gets a better sense of what people around the state,
right,
want from their governor.
There are a lot of people with good ideas who need to be squeakier wheels, because,
yes,
there's a lot of loud idiots.
Yep. Yep.
So please, smart people, speak up, show up, and participate, and maybe we can get things back on track.
Yeah.
All right, boy, this was this, you know, I'm walking away from this feeling better.
I knew I'd get you there.
It was a little bleak, a lot of grim stuff, but there's hope.
There's always hope, and we're here to find it.
All right.
So now, let's turn to our local interview. We talked a lot about Billy Sutton running at the state level.
Right.
That's not for another 15 months, though. We have an election right here in Aberdeen.
Yes.
And some other towns around the state do, too. I hear Rapid City's got city council, some others around. So, folks, if you've got a local election, get out and vote next week. Make,
mm-hmm,
that happen. Our race for school board here in Aberdeen, we've got our fourth candidate interview for school board. We have Ken Santema, who, interestingly, is a conservative blogger. I've met him before,
yeah,
online.
Yeah.
He was chair of Libertarian Party. Now he's running for Aberdeen's school board. Let's hear what Ken has to say about his aspirations.
My name is Ken Santama. I originally come from Volga, just down by Brookings there, Sioux Valley High School graduate. From there, I actually moved on to the Army. I spent 5 years as a communications technician. Got deployed 3 times, Saudi, Somalia, Bosnia. From there, I moved on to the networking world, was a system administrator, then a network engineer, and then became a project manager. I've worked all the way from Fortune 50 companies to small mom-and-pop operations. As I moved on, got married about, 13 years ago yesterday. To an Aberdeen native, actually. And then we moved to Minnesota. And we actually moved back to South Dakota a few years later because of the schools. In Minnesota, while there were some good teachers, it felt like the whole system in Minnesota set the teachers against the parents.
Not just in your community, but statewide?
In the Elk River area I was at. I did a lot of work for schools in Minnesota, actually, both private and public. And I would see it everywhere, at least around the cities. I guess I can't speak for the whole state, but around the cities, it really seemed like teachers were pit against parents. And it's sad. Here I don't see that. So
how so?
A lot of it had to do with bonds there, because all the bonds come up for a vote there. And the education associations there I would hear stuff would pit the teachers against the taxpayers, against the parents. My kids would come home during the day, and I would hear, like for my eldest, he was in middle school at that point, I would hear things like, my teacher said that because you guys voted down this bond, we don't get to have our new, I forgot what they wanted, it was a greenhouse on top of their school. Because you parents voted it down, we don't get it. Or I'd hear stuff like, we have to do another fundraiser because you parents didn't vote for the bond. And this would come right from the teachers to the kids to us. And that really created a big rift in the community.
Did other parents have similar experiences, or was that a specific teacher that liked to talk a lot?
No, I heard that from a lot of parents. I helped a friend of mine run for school board there, which he lost. But traveling around with them, we would hear these stories constantly of that happening.
And you don't hear that in South Dakota. What do you think is the difference? Are the teachers' associations in South Dakota not as strong, not as many teachers? What's the difference in the relationship as you've seen?
I think here, because we are a right-to-work state, the teachers' union has to work more with the parents, has to work more with the legislature, has to work more with all the parties involved. So if they try to pit the teachers against the parents, you're really going to lose here because we're a right-to-work state.
Ken, people know about your past political involvement. You're a prominent South Dakota political blogger. You've worked with various partisan PACs. You've been chairman of the South Dakota Libertarian Party, but you've also worked with the Republicans. You haven't worked with the Democratic Party yet, have you?
No, I haven't.
We're going to have to work on that. In your political efforts, is this your first time actually running as a candidate?
Yes and no. I was on the ballot in, 14, as a state treasurer.
For the Libertarians.
For the Libertarians.
But you said you were on the ballot, but you didn't really run for that office?
I had no time or money to run. My name was brought up at convention. It's a long story in itself, but I don't consider myself as having run then.
So this is the first time you're actively campaigning.
Correct.
To win an election.
Yes.
Tell us what that's like. I mean, transitioning from, involvement as a blogger and as kind of a party activist to now running for a nonpartisan local election.
It's hard. I like listening to people and asking them. As a blogger, I don't ask a lot of questions. I like to just sit back and listen. I love going to, the airport cafe and listening to the old guys talk in the morning. You wouldn't believe how much you learn there. But now, as a candidate, you actually have to go out and give people a message. That's hard. It's harder than I thought it would be. But it's been great. I actually hear quite a bit from people who are concerned about what's going on in our schools. The biggest concern is something I brought up during the forum is that it seems like our school board, our current school board, isn't actively going out and talking to the community. They're not going to community events as a school board member. They're not going to Chamber of Commerce events. They're not going to sporting events as a school board member. So that has been interesting to hear that. So,
what's your vision? What do you want to happen with the Aberdeen school system?
Well, that's a huge question. But the biggest thing I want to do is I think the addition of the Mike Miller Elementary was a good move for many reasons. And I love that we're implementing technology there. I would love to see more technology thrown into our schools. I think I've helped this in Minnesota as a consultant. I've helped implement wireless and laptops iPads for every student. In the schools I worked with there, the one school, they only have one textbook left. And where that really helps out is these students now have their homework wherever they go, and they're given different kinds of homework. So it's not just go in your book and answer question A on a piece of paper. They'll have interactive multimedia type homework, stuff that's just cool. The kids want to do their homework. And for kids who were struggling in a public school before that came over to this private school, they suddenly went from failing to straight A's and B's. And I think it had more to do with the use of technology than the fact it was private versus public. It was just, it allowed the teachers tools to get to those kids who otherwise wouldn't be able to, who just couldn't learn for whatever reason with the traditional method.
Sure. And technology, we're talking information technology here.
Right.
So, I mean, do you envision, it sounded like you were saying maybe even a one-to-one program, whether tablets, laptops?
Yeah, definitely. I think each kid out there should have a netpad or a tablet or whichever way is deemed necessary, you know. But, and then at the same time, I think that would save the school district money.
I was going to ask, how does this work budgetarily? Net gain, net loss? Can we afford it?
No, short term, it is a huge capital expense. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Although there are, like if you go with Apple has huge discounts for schools. And so do other companies. I just know Apple because I've worked with them. And like for implementing the actual software technology side, you have Moodle out there, you have Google out there, who will give all kinds of software away to schools, and they'll actually even do a lot of the support for you, help you set it all up. So short term, yes, it is an investment, but long term, budget cuts are going to come again. What Dugard did here however many years ago with the 10% cut, I foresee that happening again.
Why would that happen again? What economics changing? What makes you think that?
Partly economics, partly state government is growing again at a drastic rate. It's outgrowing our revenue, especially with sales tax revenues down. Another budget cut is coming, and I think it's going to be across the board again. So the schools are going to feel that. Now, the schools that have invested in this technology, they probably are going to have to cut some staff or some classes. If you're fully invested in technology, you can keep some of those classes going with fewer staff or with fewer new resources coming in.
Right. And I mean, if we're talking budget cuts, inevitably we have to look at staff, because that is the single biggest majority ticket item is salaries, paying the people who make education happen.
It is.
Well, thinking about budget issues, you know I'm going to ask about the May 6th forum where you talked about federal funding in education. You said that you wished we had a situation where there were no federal funds involved in local education. Can expand on that idea for me. When you say you wish there were no federal funds in education, what do you mean by that? And what does that turn into as practical school board member policy if you're on the board?
Well, one, I don't think that's coming anytime soon. But yeah, I would love to get rid of federal dollars. Every federal dollar comes with a mandate. Some of it silly little stuff, some of it huge. When you look at the cost of education over the last 30 years, going back to the 70s, the cost of public education has just skyrocketed over the last 30 years. But the outcomes have not skyrocketed. In fact, they've stayed pretty flat. And that's because we have all these mandates that come from all these bureaucrats in D.C., but they don't actually seem to be improving education at all. So when we take this money, we have to comply with these mandates, which also increase the cost of education. And in some cases, the cost of the increase is greater than what we're getting from D.C. Now, if we did get out of federal dollars, it would mean more local revenue would have to be generated. That would probably mean some type of tax increase. I'm an anti-tax person, but even I realize that would happen. I would be happy with that. That'd be the one tax I'd be happy to pay, something to pay for our education for our children. I know I'm mostly libertarian, but education is one place I do think we as a society should be placing a focus, and we should be putting our money in for our future generations.
Now, do you have any experience as an educator?
At the elementary or high school level, no. I do. I have taught some classes at the collegiate level, but no, not at the lower levels.
Okay, and just a quick fact check. You said you, when you say you worked with Apple, do you mean you were employed by the Apple Corporation, or do you mean that you have experience with their software?
No, I worked with them, with their consultant. I was a project manager and a network engineer, and I'd work with local Apple consultants on, I didn't mean to say I worked for Apple.
No, I'm just curious. If you're going to swap out teachers for technology, where do you, I mean, it doesn't... I've never talked to a teacher that was like, we're overstaffed. You know what I mean? So who do you think we can cut? And do you think, although I do think there's a place for technology, it does seem like we're all getting over screened to a certain extent, and maybe to our detriment. How do you feel about that balance?
I don't know what teachers would be cut. I mean, that'd be a hard decision at that point. I would think it would be some of your more... your non-core classes, and I know I'll probably get beat up for this, like your social studies, which I think is an important class, but it's not like reading, writing, and arithmetic. You could do some remote learning there, which we already have some of in the state. It would probably mean relying more upon the NSU program, remote learning for stuff like that, or like government and civics classes. You know, I think those would be the first to go, honestly. I think there would be an urge to go after the arts. Now, that's something I would fight. I really think nationwide, statewide, and even in Aberdeen to a smaller extent, we've cut too many of the arts. Now, the Aberdeen School District is kind of odd in that it really does seem to have a pretty robust arts program. But even there, I do think there have been cuts where there shouldn't have been. So.
Ken, let me take you back to the point you made about increasing mandates, but flat outcomes in education. A lot of those mandates haven't been necessarily about increasing everybody's outcomes. A lot of them have been, you know, over the last 40 years, just equal access, especially in the area of special education. So could the state still meet its own obligations to provide those special education services, even when those services aren't necessarily going to boost the school's SAT or ACT, whatever your metrics are for outcomes? They're just allowing these kids access to kind of the basic, the mainstreaming of their education. Could South Dakota do that without the federal funding?
I believe they could. I don't believe our current Department of Education would, but I believe they could. The focus isn't there at the state level right now because, honestly, like you said, that's mandated at the federal level. So there is no focus on that at the state level. But that now special education is one I'm glad you brought up because of Common Core. I've spoken to quite a few special education teachers who are absolutely not liking Common Core because the reality is special education students are not the same as other students. And that's okay, but they're in some ways being held to the same standards. So what I've heard from some of the special education teachers, especially one I just talked to in Minnehaha, it's actually causing these special education students to be more, the word she uses, traumatized. I don't know if I'd use that word, but it's making them feel like they're falling behind when they really aren't.
Okay. And you mentioned the State Department of Education, which I love to talk about. And tell, I mean, sure, the federal government, there are some mandates tied to its funding. There are certainly a lot of mandates that come to our schools from peer. Talk to us about your view of the proper role of the State Department of Education and the requirements they put on our local school districts.
Well, I don't think the State Department should be putting many, if any, requirements on the local districts. They should be there more to allow the districts to share resources. Or, like, you know, as part of the big sales tax increase, they increase budget to increase remote learning. That's, to me, the proper role of the Department of Education, the State Department of Education. Or they should be helping schools with dyslexia. It's huge. In fact, we have one of the school board candidates running on that, on dyslexia. The State Department of Education put out a flyer to help teachers understand, you know, dyslexia. I think that's where the state should be putting more research in and better online tools or courses for teachers to take to actually spot and deal with dyslexia. I have a kid, my youngest, we thought had dyslexia. It turns out it was something wrong with his eyes, and by getting him glasses, it's gone. The problem is gone. We thought he had dyslexia. We had him through a special tutor who wasn't helping at all. We got him to the eye doctor. He got new glasses. The kid is reading fine now. But, I mean, getting teachers to be able to spot dyslexia, and I've talked to teachers who admit it, they don't understand dyslexia as well as they wish they did. And two, what are when I research it, there are so many different forms of dyslexia. There are all kinds of things out there that can cause dyslexia type symptoms. And we need to get our teachers educated on that. That, to me, is the proper role of the State Department of Education.
Sure. Coordinating services and providing professional development, maybe that individual districts aren't equipped and shouldn't need to be equipped to have a specialist on staff to handle such things.
Right.
Okay. Now, back to kind of maybe a political philosophy question. You said you still consider yourself a libertarian, correct?
Small L.
Small L. Okay. you're not chairman of the party. But when someone asks you, libertarian, most liberty, least regulation or government interference. So at a school board level, and even at a student policy level, how does a small L libertarian translate that thinking into the student handbook, the rules that young people have to follow in our school districts?
And even though it's not voluntary, to me, if you're part of any organization, which even going to school, you do have to accept some rules. I really don't have a problem with students having to follow the student handbook, unless we have policies that are just way out of line. And that's a problem with the policy. Then we deal with that. But, you know, most libertarians are not complete anti-government, anti-rule.
We're not anarchists here.
Right. Most libertarians believe that all laws, regulations, and rules should be as close to you as possible. So that means maybe at the city level, at the school level, but then as you go up to the state and federal, then you're really not liking it because you're getting, it's people a long way away making these rules. To me, that's what libertarianism is all about, getting the laws as close to you as possible. Because I can go up, like on the school board, I can go up to a school board member and say, hey, I don't like this policy. Now, if something's happening in D.C., it's harder to get a hold of Thune or Rounds or whoever. So,
I've asked this question to other school board members, and I feel like it's a good question, and I think it's a nice jumping off point, too. When a student is done with their education in the Aberdeen school system, what would you like them to be? How would you like them to be, like, armed with? What tools would you like them to have?
I would like them to be the best that they can be. And that sounds corny, but what I'm saying is, if you have someone who is just outrageously great at math, I want to make sure our school system brought them to their fullest potential that they can be at. If they're great at art or music or geography or whatever, I would like our school district to have just embraced that and grow it as far as it can go. Now, that might mean some of their other subject areas aren't as high. I mean, that's okay. each person's different. And that's where I think education should be focusing, is getting the most potential out of each student to help them in life later on.
Ken, we've mentioned federal funding, role of the state, Common Core, a lot of interesting issues here. If you can point to one quick issue that you as a school board member would like to make some change in the coming years in the Aberdeen District, what would that issue be?
Well, actually, it's not even an issue. It's communication. It's openness. It's transparency. Transparency is my biggest topic. I don't believe our current board is transparent enough. From what I understand, the board meetings are recorded and archived, but they're not broadcast on YouTube. The board members don't actively go out and seek public input. In fact, we have a couple of them who said, well, we just like to do whatever the administrators tell us to do. That's not the job of the school board. The school board is to listen to the administrators, yes, but it's also to listen to the public. It's to listen to and speak with our legislators. It's to work with our city councils. There's more to the school board than just dealing with the administrators.
Ken, if voters want to learn more about your campaign, if they want to talk to you, what's the best way for them to do that?
On Facebook, I have Ken Sanema for school board. Or you can always email me anytime at sodacliberty@gmail.com. Or call me at 290-6651. I'll take a call anytime almost.
There you go, voters. Ring that phone off the hook. Ken Santema, candidate for a 3-year term on the Aberdeen School Board. Ken, thanks for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
All right, Ken. Thanks, man.
Are you feeling better now?
Yeah, I feel better.
All right.
Thank you, man.
That's what matters, Spencer. We want people to be feeling, well, you know, somewhat good.
Well, I think this was a lively discussion. Sometimes it's good to vent. And I actually do feel I feel better. I honestly do. I'm more hopeful. Thank you. All right. The Progressive Happy Hour is on hiatus for the summer, so just go sit on the beach or, you know. But that doesn't mean you can't talk about issues. You can't
talk politics with your friends at the lake.
Yeah, do it over an open fire while you cook the fish that you caught in your non-meandered waters. Other than voting, which you're going to do on Tuesday, if you haven't registered to vote, you're SOL. We don't swear on this show, but you know what that means.
Yep, you got to be registered 2 weeks before the election. So.
But you can register now, so you'll be ready next time. Yes. And it takes 2 seconds. You're a bad person if you haven't registered to vote yet. You probably don't listen to this podcast if you haven't registered to vote yet, but you can do it. It's easy.
But just remember, tell your friends, if they haven't registered to vote, they're letting idiots like us run the show who are registered to vote. So come on, believe in yourself. Don't let someone else make your decisions. Register and vote.
Questions, comments, theme songs, anything like that, email them to Corey@DakotaFreePress.com.
Yes, we love to hear from you. And that's Corey, C-O-R-Y, @DakotaFreePress.com. Send us your comments, your suggestions. We're all about a good conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
You bet. Thank you, Spencer. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Dakota Free Press.